Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 176 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. In the Middle Ages, queens were meant to be steadfast, supportive, maternal, and well-connected, and no one filled this role better than Philippa of Hainault or Hainault. But as they say, it's not that easy being queen, especially when one of your ladies-in-waiting catches the eye of your husband. For Alice Perrers, being the king's mistress wasn't always a picnic either. Through insurrection, war, plague, and infirmity, these two women would be the bedrock upon which one of medieval Europe's most legendary kings built his legacy. This week, I spoke with Gemma Holman about Philippa of Hainault and Alice Perrers, the wife and the mistress of Edward III. You may remember Gemma from way back in episode 38 when we talked about her first book, Royal Witches, From Joan of Navarre to Elizabeth Woodville. Her new book is called The Queen and the Mistress, The Women of Edward III. In addition to her books, Gemma is also the woman behind Just History Posts, a website that explores a wide range of history. Our conversation on the woman widely considered by her contemporaries to be the perfect queen and the woman who succeeded her in her husband's affections is coming up right after this.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Well, thank you, Gemma, for coming back to the podcast. I was just looking back and the last time you were here was 2019 with Royal Witches. So it's great to have you back.
Thank you for having me back. Yeah, I can't believe it's been so long. It feels like just yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. But you have a new and exciting book out today, and it's all about women's history again. So I'm really excited to talk about this with you because this is a century I love. It's some people I love. Let's just dive right in. So your book is about a queen and a mistress of the same man who is Edward III. So can you just position for us which king is Edward III?
So Edward III rules for a really big chunk of the 14th century. He comes to the throne sort of 1326, 1327, and it's quite difficult circumstances because his father is still alive and has basically been kicked off the throne by his mother. So really dramatic start to his reign. So he sort of takes over from his father, who then mysteriously dies shortly afterwards. So yeah, he's sort of king quite early on. 1327 is when he's officially proclaimed king, and he is one of the longest reigning medieval monarchs. He reigns for 50 years, so he dies in 1377. So as I said, that main chunk of the 14th century is when he's king, and so much goes on during this time. It's a real period of change. It's a time of big economic growth. So all of the mercantile classes and the traders and that, especially in London, are really seeing an upturn in fortunes, and people are getting really wealthy. So much so that this starts to worry the noble classes. And so Edward actually brings in legislation to sort of limit what people can wear, you know, the sort of fabrics they can buy, because people have suddenly gotten rich and everybody's dressing like a nobleman, and all the nobles are going, hold on a minute, we want to prove that we're nobles. So you've got all of that. You've got obviously the Black Death hits sort of right in the middle of his reign and decimates probably the majority of Europe, you know, sort of a third to a half of people in Europe. Edward is also the one who starts the Hundred Years' War with France. He sort of has a claim to the French throne through his mother, and there's just these endless wars that start through his reign and go right into the next century. And he also has time, though, for lots of frivolity. So he creates the Knightly Order, the Knights of the Garter, which even today is the most prestigious knightly order. He's got time for lots of celebrations and jousts and parties as well. So, yeah, it's a real kind of whirlwind of a time. It's also the time that English sort of starts to take over. So it's during his reign that the English Parliament is opened in English for the first time instead of French. There's so much sort of societal change going on at the time. So it's a really, really interesting period.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we have Edward's queen right in the middle of this. So the two of them actually met each other before Edward ever became king. So can you tell us, how did he meet his future wife, Philippa?
Obviously, you know, we're used to monarchs marrying for political reasons rather than for love. But this is definitely the case in Edward and Philippa's marriage. You know, she's really key to the whole invasion. So basically what had happened, to try and cut a long story short, is Edward II had throughout his reign had various sort of male favourites at court that all monarchs kind of have, tend to have some favourite people. But Edward kind of really lavished attention on his favourites. And, you know, he would really give them all of the land and money and control and power at court. And so throughout his reign, this had grated on his nobles and caused various bits of unrest. And a lot of English nobles had actually had to flee over to the French court to escape these favourites who they'd sort of double-crossed or come in the path of. So there was kind of mini English court going on at the French court. And as the sort of 1320s goes on, Edward's wife, Isabella, also falls on the raw side of these favourites. And she sees her fall from power. Edward even confiscates all of her lands. And he does it under the pretense that war with France might be brewing and her lands are in dangerous places. So he needs to take it over to, you know, make sure the country is protected. But this basically sort of takes her completely out of the reins of power. You know, she's got no money of her own to come in. She loses loads of power without having land to control. And she's really being pushed to the sidelines by these favourites. So she ends up going to the French court on a diplomatic mission because of England and France were having rising tensions in France, and the French king wanted the English to do fealty to them for these lands, and there was all these debates going on. So Isabella goes over as a diplomat because obviously she's married to the English king and her brother is the French king. So she's like this really great person in the middle to be doing this negotiation. So she goes over there and she does do her job. You know, she comes up with these terms of a treaty and everything's agreed. And the only thing that needs to be done to seal this peace is for Edward to come over to France and do homage to the French king for his lands. But this is a bit of a problem for Edward because he doesn't want to leave his favourites behind in England because he knows just how much everybody hates them. And so he's worried that if he goes over to France to do this, then someone will attack his favourites. So he's not too sure what to do. So Isabella comes up with a great idea of, well, why don't you send our oldest son, Prince Edward? He can do it on your behalf and then you can stay in England. And Edward goes, oh, yeah, this is a great idea. So he sends his oldest son over. And this was actually a really terrible idea because Isabella now has the heir to the throne in her control. And she basically says, right, I'm not coming home now. And she does this amazing propaganda display where she puts on widow's clothing. And she says that these favourites have so come between them in their marriage that it's as if she was a widow. And she's basically got a whole group of English nobles at the French court who all want to support her. She's got the heir to the throne. And so she's in this really amazing position. And basically, for the rest of the year, there's this real sort of standoff between the two of them. And Edward, King Edward, is writing furiously, telling his wife and son to come home, and they're refusing. And so all this stuff is kind of brewing. And during this time, visitors to the French court include Philippa of Hainault and her mother. And her mother and Edward's mother, Isabella, were cousins. So they were both sort of part of the French royal family. And basically, these two women start to get plotting because Philippa's father is a very wealthy count. He rules several territories in the Low Countries. And so he's a very rich and powerful man himself. And basically this deal gets struck between them that Isabella will marry Edward to Philippa. So this means that Philippa's parents know that their daughter is going to be Queen of England one day. So they're really happy with this marriage. And in return for Philippa's dower payment, her father will provide Isabella and Edward with ships and men for them to sail over to England to try and get rid of these favourites. So they make this deal, but it's a bit of a precarious deal because although Isabella had control of Edward, she technically couldn't marry him off. The only person who could marry him off is his father, and he needs his permission. And they also need the permission of the Pope because their mothers are cousins, they're second cousins. So they're closely related within the forbidden degrees as decreed by the church. So they're too closely related. So they need the king's permission and the Pope's permission, and they've got neither. So it's kind of like this deal, but it really hinges on this invasion being successful. And luckily for Isabella and Edward, it was, you know, as soon as they land in England, everybody who's left in England goes, oh, thank goodness, because they all love Isabella and they hate the favourites. So everybody supports this initially small invasion force. And yeah, it's just a wild success and they managed to take over. And as I said before, you know, Edward ends up being deposed. And so Philippa kind of becomes Queen of England a lot sooner than anybody anticipated.
Yes, a lot sooner. But I mean, of course, as you say, her actually becoming Queen of England is a huge part of how the invasion worked in the first place. So she was actually kind of lucky because her sisters were both, something you mentioned in the book, both married to much older men. And here she is. She's got a handsome Prince of England who's close to her age. Do you think that made a big difference in their relationship?
I think so, yeah. I mean, in this kind of level of society, obviously it wasn't too unusual for there to be a bit of an age gap between the bride and groom. But yeah, one of her older sisters had a really, really big age gap. The guy that she was marrying was literally old enough to be her father. And in fact, he had a daughter who was about her same age. So, you know, it was a big age gap for that. And she had also sort of seen the unhappiness of her sisters, you know, one of her other sisters who had gotten married again to a slightly older man who's about twice her age, not as bad, only twice her age. But, you know, she had been married off very young, sort of on the edge of being a teenager, and she was suffering terribly from it. You know, she had real bad homesickness, and she sort of came back to her parents' court for a few months just so that she could spend some time with her family. She was having such a rough time. So although Philippa was, you know, only a similar age herself, 12, 13, she had seen firsthand, oh, my sisters have had these really, really old marriages with men who are not on their same level and are having a really horrible time. So I'm sure that she would have been concerned about her own future, and she definitely would have been thinking about it. You know, her sisters were both married at similar ages, so it would have been on her mind. So yeah, I think it definitely would have been good for her to at least have someone her own age. That still doesn't obviously guarantee that the marriage is going to work. You know, there are plenty of marriages of people the same age that didn't work, but I think it just would have been a bit more reassuring, you know, to have someone who's going through the same stage of life as her, and that they were able to grow up together and sort of, you know, come of age together. And I think that did really help with their closeness, especially because the first few years of Edward's reign, the couple were really sort of shoved into the background. You know, Isabella really wanted the power for herself, and she takes the spotlight. And I think that, again, was a bonding experience, that they're these two teenagers who are just being told what to do by, you know, Edward's mom and everything. And so it's quite relatable in that way, that they would pull closer together.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And when we're talking about these love stories between Edward and his wife and then later his mistress, I think that human element, that real day-to-day element, makes a huge difference when it comes to how people relate to each other. And I think it's really important not to forget that.
Yeah, definitely. As you say, you know, it's easy to think about how long ago they lived and that these were kings and queens. But Philippa was about 14 years old when she became Queen of England. I think back to when I was 14 and like I could barely get out of bed and get dressed and go to school, you know, and do my homework. And she's there literally ruling a kingdom. Obviously, she wouldn't have had too much personal responsibility, but, you know, she still had a lot on her shoulders, and she's moved to a foreign country. She's got to learn different languages, different customs, and learn how to behave because everybody is going to be watching her, remembering her age at the time and remembering just what would it have been like on a normal day, you know, just seeing her husband at breakfast and, you know, going on a walk. And you do forget some of those more normal interactions when you're thinking about this kind of level of society.
Yes. And it's challenging for Philippa because not only is she a teenager that's become queen, but she's a teenager that's become queen in a country that already has a queen. So yes. So how did that work between the two of them? How do you see that interaction playing throughout their lives?
I think their relationship is quite interesting. You know, it's a bit hard to trace at times. And obviously, Philippa has to kind of defer to Edward in many ways. But Philippa seems to have been very sort of magnanimous with everything. As I said, the first few years of her time in England, she's really just put on a purse string, really. She barely has a couple of £100 to herself, which although, of course, in terms of general society at the time, a couple of £100 is quite a lot of money. You know, there were lowly knights who owned one or two castles who had that much money, and she's the queen. So she was really in relative poverty and really gets, as I said, shoved in a corner. Her coronation gets delayed for several years just because Isabella doesn't want another crowned queen there to sort of be her rival. And it's only when she becomes pregnant that she's finally able to have her coronation. So she really is not treated that well by Isabella. But it seems that, you know, she might not have necessarily have held too much ill will towards her, or at least that the sort of passage of time, you know, allowed her to forgive her somewhat. Because later on in life, they definitely seem to have had a bit more of a relationship. As Edward gets a bit older, him and his mother kind of seem to draw a bit closer again. And in the last few years of her life, you know, they have lots of visits between them. And Philippa and Isabella have their own meetings, you know, without Edward. You know, we know that they've had dinner together, just the two of them and things like that. So they definitely have their own kind of relationship. And it definitely all seems to be sort of on friendly terms, but you can never quite know. And especially with records this old, you know, we don't have the things like personal diaries or too many letters surviving, so we can't know Philippa's thoughts on her mother-in-law too much. But definitely throughout her life, Philippa really took up the responsibility of being a generous, forgiving, lenient queen. And I think she really picks this up during her sort of first few years in England, and she sees how Isabella is acting and how people are reacting to that, and really learns how she should behave to be seen as a good queen. And part of that is being this family woman and bringing the mother back into the fold.
Yeah, she seems like a very intelligent woman. As much as the chroniclers kind of put her to the background, is something that you mentioned in the book as well, she doesn't get a lot of credit. But I don't think she would be writing down in a diary what she really thought of anyone, because she seems very savvy. And you're right, I think part of that probably comes from the way she was raised and then watching the tumultuous time that was happening when she first was married.
Yeah, definitely. It all sort of has an impact. I mean, she was clearly brought up very well at her parents' court. They had a big emphasis on family, for one thing. They were a very, very close family. And they had a big emphasis on arts and learning. You know, there's so many books and this real sort of culture of learning and reading and poetry at her parents' court. And so they had clearly, you know, really educated her well. And her mother was, you know, a very ruler as well. So she obviously bestowed all these lessons on her of how to behave. And as you say, that was just really solidified in these first few years in England. She actually, in a way, was kind of benefited from being in the background a bit, because she doesn't sort of immediately have to learn how to do everything in a public light. You know, she can take that time to sort of spend time with some of her ladies in waiting, learn about the English culture, learn about what's expected of her before she has to kind of take over that spotlight role. Mm-hmm. And as you say, you know, she clearly took it all on board and was determined to act in that way. And I think part of that does come out of this really loving relationship with Edward. You know, she's seen the horrible childhood he's had with his fighting parents. They've drawn close across this time, and she decides, right, you know, I love this man and I want to do everything I can to support him and give him a loving family. And throughout her life, you know, all of the decisions she makes is always the way to support Edward the most. And, you know, this even means with the start of the Hundred Years' War against France, loads of her relatives and like quite close relatives are literally on the other side of the battlefield. And she doesn't waver from her support in Edward once. So she really was determined to be the best ruler she could be. And contemporaries noticed this. And that's why, you know, they thought she was so amazing, because she just couldn't put her foot wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about their relationship itself, because I think this is, again, kind of an anomaly, especially if you look at Edward III's parents, who didn't have a lot of kids, didn't spend a lot of time together, didn't seem to like each other very much at all. But this is the polar opposite between Edward and Philippa. They're together all the time, and they have, well, the result of this is that they have 12 children, I think, right?
Yes, yeah, lots and lots of babies. And they're in really quick succession. So her first 11 are born within 18 years of each other, which is something that just constantly blows my mind. The idea of having that many children anyway, but so close together. She was pretty much always pregnant or recovering from giving birth for the first decade, two decades of their marriage, really. It's a good demonstration of their closeness. They clearly weren't having relations just out of duty. Even contemporaries sort of noticed this. One of the local chronicles, I can't remember off the top of my head which county it is, but basically they were writing about one time when Philippa and Edward were on progress across the country, and they went to stay at this monastery. And the monks basically said, "Ooh, we're not too sure about this. You know, our founder and our patron saint wouldn't be too keen on having a man and wife sleeping here together. So do you mind sleeping apart?" And Philippa sort of happily complies, and she goes off and stays in the local castle in the town instead. But this is really noteworthy. First of all, they think that this is great. Oh, isn't she wonderful that she just agreed to this with no problem? But lots of historians have kind of picked up on the fact that it was expected that they were going to sleep in the same room, which, you know, again, is quite noteworthy. You know, obviously people of this status have separate bedrooms, and that's the normal thing. You know, it's not weird for the husband and wife to sleep in a different room and stuff. But it was clear that, you know, they liked to sleep in the same room together, so much so that the monks have to actively ask them not to. So, you know, as I said, even contemporaries were like, yeah, they really like each other. And again, this sort of plays into Philippa's braveness as well, because Edward was very busy with his wars. He's quite a warmonger. He spends most of his reign fighting the Scots and the French. And Philippa is there alongside him. You know, she travels up to Scotland with him and stays in the castles up there whilst he's fighting the Scots. And she travels over to France, and she's at the siege of Calais for months on end whilst he's sieging them. And she even goes off on her own to the Low Countries to meet with her sister for sort of political debates. She has several of her children abroad because, again, she's been following Edward for so long that they've been abroad for several years, and they've had more babies whilst they're out there. So she's really on the front lines this whole time, and not only on the front lines, but on the front lines whilst pregnant. It definitely really is a testament to the strength of their relationship that they really did want to spend so much time together.
Yeah, I think it can be easy to miss when you look at the lists of children, that you look at a family tree, for example, but like Lionel of Antwerp and John of Gaunt are named after continental cities because their mother was with their father when they were campaigning. It's pretty incredible, I think.
It's really poignant in many ways that, you know, that they did want to be together for that much time. And there's another time when Edward's over in France that Philippa has to be left behind in England because she's about to give birth, so she physically can't leave. And then she gives birth to her child. She sort of has the month wait, has her churching, and then pretty much straight away is like, right, I'm going to go join Edward. I'm going to sail back over the seas. And this is a woman who is really maternal and loves being around her children, and she's still kind of leaving her newborn child behind because she wants to be back with her husband. It's really interesting that you can see just how close they were. It's a real testament to both of them.
Yeah, one of my favorite details that you have in the book is that they have their 12th child, who's a bit of a surprise because Philip is over 40, I think, or she's close to 40 when she gets pregnant, which is kind of unusual for this time. And even though Thomas is a surprise and he's child number 12, they still have a tournament, they still have feasts, they still celebrate this 12th child as much as they did the ones that came before. And I think that is just such a beautiful moment for this royal family who could easily have been cold in their familial relationships.
Yeah, definitely. And it is something that the pair of them really do get praised by for historians, because the other thing is, you know, having that many children when you're a king is actually kind of a bit of a disadvantage.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people who want a lot of power, and especially they had so many sons as well. And, you know, you'd had previous kings who had had a really rough time with having so many children. King Richard the Lionheart and John and their brother Henry, they all rebel against their father because they're all there like, well, you know, you're king, but I've got nothing to do. And, you know, I want to have some power. And so, you know, you have all this infighting and Eleanor of Aquitaine is their mother and supporting them. And, you know, you have all of this family discord. And that was with only three or four sons. And then Edward and Philip have got this huge, huge family. And there's just not really any hints at all that they have any fallings out. You know, they seem like a really close family. The children and their surviving household accounts that we've got, they're giving presents to each other at Christmas and nice little bits of jewellery and clothes and things like this. They spend time together. And Philippa has most of the children with her most of the time when they're growing up, which again is quite unusual. You know, often children would go off into their own households. And their oldest son, Edward the Black Prince, does have his own household because he's the heir to the throne. So he kind of has to by convention. But all the other children just stay with her until they're old enough to go off on their own. And so this just makes this really close connection between them all. And Edward is also really clever as they grow up to make sure that all of his sons do have something to do. He has learned from previous monarchs who have had these issues. And so he makes sure that each son has married off to somebody that they can have their own territory and their own way to get off energy. So Lionel, he sends off to Ireland. He marries to a rich Irish heiress. So he goes over to Ireland to try and, you know, wrangle control of there. And then Prince Edward, the Black Prince, he goes off to Aquitaine and southern France and helps look after his father's frontier there. And John of Gaunt initially marries a rich Lancastrian heiress, but then he goes on in later life to marry a Castilian princess. And so then he's off in Spain trying to get that throne. So he really finds ways to divert their energy so that they're doing something and they feel like they've got their own thing to claim and they don't then need to fight him for power. It's a real kind of combination of Philippa's motherly upbringing and Edward's clever political maneuvering that just makes this a really successful family. And obviously it has consequences in the next century because it kind of leads to the Wars of the Roses. But you know, that's not necessarily their fault. That's not something that they could have foreseen. So they do, for their time, you know, they do really well with the family.
Yeah, it's surprising. And it's a nice story. It's a nice story, I think. So they rule together successfully. They are both ideal in their roles. They have a really tight family. And yet, we have to get to the second half of your book. Right at the end of their marriage, someone else steps onto the scene. So tell us what happens right near the end of their marriage.
It's as we get to the 1360s. The couple have been married for 30 years. And as you say, they've had really successful marriage. There's no hints of anything, any discord or anything that's gone wrong in their marriage at any point. And Philippa ends up with a new lady in waiting. And this is a woman called Alice Perez. And she's come from a relatively lowly station in life. She's come from a family of London goldsmiths. So she's in this class that's really seen this upturn during Edward's reign. So they're doing very well for themselves. And she'd actually been previously married to another goldsmith who had been supplying jewels to the king himself. So, you know, she was doing really well in terms of general society for herself. She was able to buy some nice clothes and have a nice house. But in terms of, you know, the hierarchy of the court, she's a nobody. And she manages to find her way into Philippa's household. And she kind of just gets catapulted into this world of glitz and glamour. And, you know, there's captive French nobles there because Edward had managed to capture the French king. And so he's out on ransom. And there's all of these really powerful French nobles who are in England for his surety. So she's seeing these most powerful men, you know, in sort of Western Europe on a daily basis. And she's being involved in these tournaments and these feasts. And she has these lovely clothes provided by her for being part of Philippa's household. So she's just in this completely other world. And very soon that sort of benefit leads to the eyes of the king, and Edward's eyes do wander. And there's no real hints that at any other point in their marriage, Edward had been unfaithful. Obviously, we're never going to know the full extent, but there's no sort of suggestions from contemporaries. And the sort of one or two suggestions that there are all sort of propaganda from the French who are trying to discredit his name. And we can kind of disprove those ones. So this kind of is a really unique point that Alice has really really captivated him. And part of this, lots of people think, is really because at this time, Philippa starts to become really unwell. And she struggled with her health for quite a few years. You know, having that many babies obviously puts a big toll on your body. And there's lots of evidence that she struggled with quite a few of her pregnancies. And on top of this, she has a really severe riding accident that really severely injures her shoulders. And she took sort of months to recover from. So at this point, she's really slowed down in life, even though she's not that old. She's sort of in her 50s. So she could be expected to live for quite a few more years. Isabella lived into her nearly her 80s. So she sort of has this chance to still live for many, many more years. But she is really taking it slow. The royal court isn't moving about as much anymore. You know, Edward is staying close to London in the south to sort of be with her. Things are more quiet and he kind of has this chance to look around, and his wife isn't able to provide him with the same comforts that she might have been able to before. And suddenly there's this young, beautiful woman in the household who's clearly, you know, very intelligent, very charming, and just captivates his attention. And so finally, after all these years, he starts up an affair with Alice. And it becomes a very serious one. You know, it's not just a fling. They are together from then until his death, and they have three children together. So he becomes a father three more times. And yeah, so he does become unfaithful to Philippa, but is then faithful to the two of them in that way. You know, he sort of, he has this relationship with Alice, but he's not suddenly become this philandering man who's sleeping with everybody. You know, he's faithful with Alice after Philippa dies until his death. So it's really these two women that just have captured his heart.
Yes. And one of the tricky things about this, I think, is when they overlap, which is kind of a strange way to think about it, but when their time together overlaps, we don't have a sense of what Philippa thinks about Alice, whether she knows if it's going on. I think it would be hard for her not to know what was going on. But I mean, this isn't the type of thing that Philippa would really gossip about anyway. She just doesn't seem to be that type of person. But have you seen any clues as to what she might have thought about this?
Yeah, it's quite frustrating, really, because as you say, there's really, really very little that we have to go on to gauge how she felt. Previous historians have their own theories and opinions. And, you know, quite a few people have kind of said, oh, well, you know, it was really common for men at that level to have affairs. So Philippa probably just accepted it. She probably wasn't that pleased, but she probably turned a blind eye. And I've even seen some people go, well, Philippa actually gave her blessing to it. You know, she knew that she was sick and dying, so she wanted Edward to be happy and she gave her blessing. And all of these just kind of come out of nowhere. You know, there's no support for any of this. On my own opinion, personally, I don't think that Philippa would have been completely thrilled. Obviously, yes, she was a woman of her time and she knew that men did do this. I mean, her own father had had many affairs and she had about 9 illegitimate half siblings from her father. So, you know, she's very well aware that men will do this. But I think it's important for us to remember that just because it was more accepted at the time, it doesn't mean that everybody was having affairs, like, just because, oh, nobody cared. So, you know, all of the men were sleeping with loads of women. You know, we've got so many examples of high status men who were loyal to their wives. And as I said, we've got no evidence that before Alice, Edward had ever had any affair, you know, even a one night stand, if you want to put it that way. They've been married for 30 years. I think on a human level, there's very few people who would be like, oh, well, you know, we've been married for 30 years and he's the love of my life and we have all these children. But, well, you know, if he wants to sleep around with another woman, then what the heck? You know, I'm sure that she must have been hurt. And the fact as well is that Alice was part of Philippa's household. You know, this is a woman who she has to spend every single day with, who's there to serve her and look after her and accompany her to all of these events. And so, you know, it's not just that he's having an affair with a woman. He's having an affair with a woman who she is with all the time and who in other circumstances she'd be really good friends with. So there's kind of that level of betrayal there as well. And so whilst we don't have many records, there's a few suggestions that Philippa might have requested Alice to leave her household. And it's a bit hard to tell because Philippa's household records are really patchy. We don't have a full run, so it's really hard to compare what's happening year on year. But there is a point towards the end of Philippa's life where we have the Christmas liveries. And so this is where the ladies of her household would be given new clothes at Christmas time. And Alice isn't on this list. So it's been suggested that Philippa had said, right, this is it. I've had enough. If you're going to have your relationship with her, I just don't want her in my household. You know, have it elsewhere. Don't have it under my nose. And it's definitely a very valid theory. And, you know, that document could support that. But it's just not quite enough evidence, because women would come and go from the Queen's household. They might serve her for a few years and then go away and have some children and then come back again. It was probably around this time that Alice had one of her own children with Edward. So she might just not have been at Christmas that year because she might have been giving birth or looking after her own children. And part of the reason we can't quite tell is that at Philippa's funeral, Alice is listed alongside all the rest of Philippa's ladies in waiting as receiving mourning clothes to wear at the funeral. So that suggests that she might have still been part of her household. But also, again, it's still not clear. It might just be that Edward wanted her at the funeral, so she got given some clothes and was invited. So, yeah, the records are really frustrating in that. But as I said, you know, if we're going to be wildly speculating, my personal thing is that I don't think that Philippa would have been happy, and I don't think it would have had her blessing. And I think she probably was forced to just bear it quietly and everything. And maybe to the end, maybe she did kind of accept it and see that, you know, it was a loving relationship, and maybe she did have some comfort knowing that Edward would have someone after she died. We just don't know, and it's very frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, there's points in which you mentioned that Frissart, like Jean Frissart, who was one of Philippa's countrymen who was writing and was part of her household as well, he doesn't always get his details right. But when Philippa dies, one of the things that he says she asks of Edward is that they are buried together. And if this is something that's true, I think that might hint at her feelings about this too, that like he might possibly think about being married next to Alice. And this is one thing that she asks of him. And she rarely asks anything of him from what we can tell, other than like in queenly duties as intercessor. But this could be really telling too, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Like, yeah, you might be with her, but when we're both dead, you're spending eternity with me, mister. Yeah, no, definitely. I think, as you say, I think that is a good pointer as well, that, you know, she is still determined at the end to be like, no, you know, let's be together. You know, I want you and you should be with me, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think at the point she dies, Edward and Alice have been in a relationship for something like 2 years, and their relationship continues afterwards. And then things get a little bit dicey. So tell us how their relationship went after Philippa dies.
After Philippa dies, Alice kind of quite quickly gets thrust into the spotlight. So the evidence all points to the fact that Edward and Alice had been very, very discreet during the lifetime of the Queen. And, you know, there's obviously lots of reasons for that. You know, Edward clearly did still love Philippa, so he wouldn't have wanted her to be embarrassed and humiliated by everybody knowing that he's carrying on with someone else. He also had cultivated this really family father figure in his own reputation. So it doesn't really kind of tally with that to be like, oh, yes, you know, I'm the most perfect and loyal husband and father. Oh, but I've also got a mistress. And there's also a safety aspect to it, where just a couple of years before Alice joins the royal household, the Scottish king, he had a mistress who he had brought back with him from England. And the Scottish nobles had been so frustrated by the power that this mistress had that they actually murdered her. So, you know, Alice could potentially be in danger for their relationship as well. So that's another reason to kind of keep it all on the down low. There's not really any evidence that many people outside the royal circle were aware of the relationship during the lifetime of the Queen. But after Philippa dies, Alice and Edward kind of are just left to their own devices, and their relationship can grow stronger. And Edward sort of starts to give her like a few more sort of gifts and things. He's still very restrained in what he gives Alice. You know, he doesn't lavish her with loads and loads of land and wealth and all of this. A lot of what she has, she builds up by herself. But she starts to build up all these connections at court. And as I said, people are very quickly aware that she is with the king and the king is loyal to her. And so now that there isn't a queen around, that Alice might be an avenue for getting favours at court. And anybody and everybody was happy to go to Alice for help. And one thing that I always find so amazing when she's supposedly this really immoral mistress is that even the Pope writes to her in 1371. His brother is being held captive by a French noble who is loyal to Edward. And so he writes to various people at court. He writes to some of the princes, you know, some of Edward's sons and some of the powerful bishops and things like that to try and get his brother freed. But the only woman he writes to is Alice. Mm-hmm. So even the Pope's like, well, she might be a mistress, but if she can get my brother freed, I don't care. You know, she's clearly someone who's important, so I'll write to her. So mm-hmm. yeah, it's really, really interesting that to show just how powerful she was just 2 years after the Queen's death, that even the Pope's writing to her. And also just like how quickly her reputation has grown. You know, the fact that the Pope all the way over in a different country knows that she exists and she's a powerful woman, like the word's clearly spread. And so she uses all of these connections to build up this really powerful landed empire. She makes all these deals with people at court. She lends people money. She trades land and sort of gets discounts on some land from Edward. And she just builds up this huge portfolio, and she becomes one of the richest people in the entire country. You know, not just one of the richest women, the richest people. You know, she's basically rivaling the princes at this point with how much she's got. And so it's a really meteoric rise for someone who was the daughter of a London goldsmith and was a nobody and just sort of stumbled her way into court. But obviously, you know, people at court aren't always too happy with someone having a big rise, and even less so when they are a woman.
mm-hmm. Do you have any sense, I know you do because it's in the book a little bit, of how Edward's children reacted to this new relationship?
Yeah, so again, trying to untangle what people thought of each other at this time is so difficult because so many of the records we have are just official records. It's a bit unclear with his children, but she certainly would have been closer with some of them than others. Several of them, like the Black Prince, had spent the whole time in a different country, you know, all through the 60s when she's rising at court. So she only would have met him, you know, after Philippa died. So she probably wasn't too close with him. But John of Gaunt, certainly, they seem to have got something of a friendship together. In some of John of Gaunt's household records, there's a gift of him giving her a silver cup. And this is at a time he's giving various other members of the royal family presents, and he's given one to her. So this definitely shows a connection between them. But this is where it's really difficult with records, because just because he gave her a present doesn't mean he likes her. You know, he might just be like, well, I have to give you a present because you're my dad's girlfriend, but I don't really like you, but you know, here's a present. Just because she got a present from him doesn't mean they liked each other. But there are definitely suggestions that he's at least on friendly terms with her. Later on in life, when his father is on the brink of death, Alice had actually been kicked out of the court by Parliament, who weren't too happy with her relationship with the king. And so they'd told her to leave the king's presence. Edward comes really close to death. Everybody's convinced he's going to die, and then he manages to survive. And after this happens, John of Gaunt calls Alice back to court to be his father. And again, you know, it's still a bit tricky to dissect this. Is it that he liked her and wanted her to be reunited with his father, you know, for her sake? Or was it just that his dad nearly died and he wants his dad to have some comfort in the last moments of his life, kind of thing? And there definitely seems to have been like at least a cordial understanding. In terms of Edward's oldest daughter, Isabella, there's maybe a bit more animosity. After Edward dies, Isabella submits a petition to Parliament saying that Alice had stolen some land from her and her husband. So that definitely suggests that Isabella might not have been too keen on her. But I think in general, you know, that I think the royal family must have at least tolerated her. I mean, you know, they'd have to be, she's always around the king. And so if they want to spend time with him, then they'll have to spend time with her as well. But again, I think when you look at it on a human aspect, by the time Edward dies, they've been together for probably about 15 years. And so, you know, if you're seeing someone over all that time, seeing that they're making your father happy, they probably at least tolerated her, yeah. I'm sure. And, you know, one of the points I make in the book is, well, if Edward liked her so much, she must have had some good qualities. You know, if he only ever loved one other woman, why would he only love the second woman being someone who's really, really horrible? So she must have been kind of nice. So, you know, if Edward loved her, then there's no reason that other people wouldn't like her too. I'm sure she wouldn't have been really rude to his children because she knows that she needs allies at court, and being really horrible to the prince and princess is not really going to be the best way to get about things. So, yeah, I'm sure they had at least a cordial relationship, if nothing else.
Yeah, I would think that is fair. And this is another time where it would be so nice to actually be a fly on the wall if we just can't get there. But yeah. Alice is the person who has a big story about her that makes her hated in the century since, and that surrounds Edward's death. So what's the story about Alice and Edward's death?
We've got a very sort of prolific chronicler, a man called Thomas Walsingham, and he is an abbot at St. Albans Abbey. So he writes a chronicle that sort of covers Edward's reign, which is obviously, you know, a really key source for what's going on. But the problem is that Thomas Walsingham did not like Alice at all. You know, he's a very religious man and she's an immoral mistress. So that's already a mark against her. She's a social upstart. So that's another mark against her. And she is involved during the height of her power at court. She's involved in land disputes with St. Albans Abbey. And because she's the king's mistress, she's winning the cases. So that's another reason for him to hate her. So, yeah, he is very, very unflattering of her throughout his chronicle. He calls her all sorts of names. He says that, you know, she was really ugly and horrible, and it was just pure luck that she managed to charm the king and all these horrible things. But in many ways, it's kind of great how much he hated her, because it meant he just kept on writing about her. And so it's a really great source, because otherwise, you know, women don't tend to turn up in chronicles very much. And she's there on every page, practically. So he loves to hate her. But yes, he writes this story of Edward's death. And it's very dramatic. You know, he's sort of saying that the king has become very senile. He's very smitten with love with Alice, and it's making him sick. He's really a king who's had a great fall, you know, in his final days. All he can talk about is going off hunting and hawking and, you know, all of this nonsense kind of thing. You know, what a crazy old man. And basically says that, you know, he's alienated everybody from him. And as he's dying, the only people there is Alice and a priest. And as the king starts to die, you know, it's his final moments. Alice kind of notices, okay, this is it. And so she pulls the rings off of his fingers and she flees the room. And Edward is left to die alone with just this priest there to hear his confessions. And it's so dramatic. And it's a really slanderous story against us. And it's one that people have run with for centuries. You know, people have believed this. He's a reputable chronicler. She's an evil mistress who was really greedy. So, you know, why wouldn't she have done this kind of thing? In reality, there's just no way this happened. First of all, it's just not feasible for a medieval king to be dying, especially someone who'd reigned as long as Edward. There's so many things that need to be done. You know, medieval monarchs are never alone. You know, at all times, they've got servants all around them. They've got knights and companions. Lots of monarchs don't even sleep alone in their room. They've got servants that sleep in the room with them. And so the idea that nobody at court is there as the king is dying, it's very important to know when the king dies, because you need to know when to go crown the other king. And then as well, you know, this idea that we were talking about earlier, that Edward and Philippa had such a close family. His children loved him. And the idea that his children wouldn't be there as he's dying is nonsense. And Thomas Walsingham even contradicts himself in this. You know, when he's talking about Edward's final days and how sick he was, he says that Alice and his daughter Isabella both stayed with him throughout the night to nurse him. So he's even said beforehand that his daughter's there. So yeah, the idea that nobody would be there at all apart from Alice and a priest is just physically nonsense. And then on top of that, you know, the idea that she'd stolen these rings from his fingers, you know, he sort of says that these were his royal rings. You know, these were the things that give him status and show his that he's the king. So they're clearly very, very important rings. So if she'd stolen these rings from his fingers, again, somebody would notice. They'd be like, hold on a minute, where's those really important kingly rings that he used to be wearing? And the official records show no accusations against Alice that she had stolen anything from Edward, you know, any jewellery or anything, let alone great estate rings that they would need to be passing on to his successor. So, yeah, it's a great story and it's really contributed to her evil reputation, but it just isn't feasible.
Yeah, well, we couldn't have this episode without talking about that story. Mm. But I think the two death scenes, Philippa's death scene and Edward's death scene in these chronicles really contrast these two figures. So as we wrap up, can you tell us, why did you want to tell a story with these two figures together in the same book?
Yeah, so it's kind of one that started out of necessity and then very quickly became something that I thought was really important to do. Alice was a figure that, you know, I'd known about for a while, and I was really, really interested in writing about her. And it kind of followed on nicely from my first book, which was about royal witches, so these other scandalous women. And so I liked the idea of doing another scandalous woman. And when I sort of was doing my initial research, I was like, oh, wow, we really don't know anything about Alice. You know, she's such an enigma. And I was like, oh, I don't really know that I can write a book just on her, which later on, as I was doing my research and writing, I realised was completely not true. I could have written so much more about her. But at the time, I wasn't too sure, you know, whether I could do a book just on her. And so, of course, I knew about Philippa. I'd written about her before at university. And so I was like, OK, well, you know, why don't we take a different angle? You know, rather than just doing Alice, why don't we look at Alice and Philippa together? And, you know, it is really interesting that these are the only two women that Edward had been with. In the past, when kings had been unfaithful, it was normally to lots of different women and generally wasn't super long lasting or anything. Mm-hmm. So it is really interesting that this man who'd been with this one woman for his whole life suddenly takes on another woman. And I was like, well, they've got these completely contrasting reputations. You know, everything I was reading about Philippa was how amazing she was, how great she was, just the most ideal, perfect queen. And everything I was reading about Alice was, oh, she's the most evil woman and she's a seductress and she's greedy and she's stealing the rings from the king. And I was like, well, how can one man love these two completely opposite women? I was like, there's got to be something more here. You know, what connects the two of them? And I thought it'd be really interesting to just explore their lives side by side and see, well, how can this happen? You know, how would he change to move over this way? And what is similar about them? And, you know, there are lots of similarities between them. They both were very maternal and sort of championed the rights of their children and, you know, wanted the best for them, wanted them to have the best start in life. They were both clearly very intelligent. Philippa, as I said, we know is educated from her parents' court and is very intelligent throughout her life. But, you know, Alice must have been so, so clever as well. You know, the fact that she has come from this lower class background and yet she manages to do these incredible business deals that even historians today are just like, how did she do this? You know, I was reading these records and I was like, I don't understand any of this. And how is she doing it, you know, 700 years ago? So she was clearly really intelligent as well. That's a trait that they have in common that Edward obviously appreciated. So there's all of these different strands that you can pull out that they are both very independent women who want to assert their rights and who love the same man. And yeah, I think it is really interesting and important to see them side by side and how two different women hold power at the same court in very different ways. And the other thing I think is really interesting comparing them is looking at the gendered aspect. You know, we know that the medieval period is this very patriarchal society and there's all of these expectations of a woman. And so how could two very different women use their femininity in very different ways to get power? And what was the results of this? You know, Philippa does it in a very traditional way, and so everybody loves her. And Alice does it in a completely new, groundbreaking way, and people aren't too keen on this. So yeah, it is. It's really interesting just seeing them side by side. And I think it makes both of their stories richer, particularly because they were at court together. They were friends. They worked together. And so it's important not just to look at them in isolation and, you know, what was it like when they were both alive, both in the household and both sleeping with the king? I just think they're both really, really interesting women who have both been somewhat overlooked in different ways. And I was just really excited to write about both of them.
Well, thank you so much for introducing the listeners to the Medieval Podcast to these two women, because I think that they are endlessly fascinating. And I hope that people will have a look at your book and learn more about them. So thanks so much, Gemma.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great fun to chat about them.
To find out more about Gemma's work, you can follow her on social media at Gemma H. Author or at Just History Posts. Her website is justhistoryposts.com, and her book, The Queen and the Mistress, The Women of Edward III, is out now in the UK and in the spring in North America. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's going on across the world and on the website. Hey, Peter, welcome back.
Hey, yeah. I guess everyone's talking about Twitter, and I guess we should talk about medieval Twitter.
Yes. So what's your impression of things on Twitter right now?
It's chaotic to say the least, right? Like, I love Twitter and I want to be on it, but like, you know, you read the headlines and you go on Twitter itself and it seems, I think, as you kind of mentioned before, imploding on itself, right? Yeah. Which is really worrisome. So,
yeah. But you're hanging out on Twitter until it becomes untenable, right? You're still hanging out there?
Oh, yeah. We've got at Medievalists on Twitter, and we've got a pretty, you know, strong following, 83,000. So thank you so much if you're one of them. I always like to post on it. I love to take a look at what other people are posting and kind of retweet it. So I'm hoping it'll stay the same, but I'm starting to look, hey, what other kind of social media channels are out there? New ones or ones that we haven't really explored too much, and see where all the kids are going to. Right?
All right. Tell the kids where to find medievalist.net. So where are you right now? And are there places that you're expanding to?
You know, it's funny. We started off with Facebook way back when we actually started the website. Facebook was our first one. And we always had a really big following there. So you can follow us there. We've got Instagram, Tumblr, which I like posting to. I've just started a TikTok page. I'm not very good at doing videos.
It's a learning curve, right?
It is. I'm looking at suggestions on, like, hey, what should we enter into the social media world? Where can we talk about the Middle Ages and have an audience? And yourself?
Well, I am still on Twitter. I'm going to stay on Twitter. That's where I have the most followers, except for this podcast. And I've loved Twitter. It's been really good. It's been really helpful for me to learn stuff. It's where I found stuff. It's where I found guests for the podcast. So I really love it, but I do feel like it is collapsing a bit. So we'll have to see how that goes. In the meantime, I'm still going to stay there until it becomes a problem. Like if it becomes a liability for my privacy, or, you know, that it's too hard to understand who everyone is on Twitter, then I'll have to rethink and maybe come off it. But until that point, I'm going to stay there because I do like that community. So I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, I'm on YouTube, and I'm on TikTok, but not very often. And I'm always under the handle of @5minmedievalist. So I made a Mastodon account, although I haven't really done much with it yet. That is @5minmedievalist. And for Mastodon, it's @hcommons.social. But I mean, who knows what I'm going to do with Mastodon. I don't really love Facebook, but I think I'm going to have to come back there. So if you're looking for me, Facebook and Instagram might be good places to do that. But I mean, we're just going to have to see how it goes. I'm going to have to up my video game, I think, in order to keep up. But yeah, I'm just going to kind of see how it goes. But if you want to find me, you can always look for my name or 5MIN Medievalist, because I'm trying to keep that consistent across platforms.
It's amazing to think how, you know, in the last 20 years, social media has all these ups and downs and changes, and what becomes interesting and what becomes hot, and then what falls by the wayside. And you think, oh, this is the greatest place to go. And then it's not. So,
yeah, I mean, the speed at which things are going south is kind of stunning. But yeah, I really like my Twitter community and I really love the people there, and they've been so supportive. So yeah, I'm going to stick it out for now. And if you need to find me across platforms, if you are one of the people jumping ship, you can find me at 5MIN Medievalist. And right now I'm using the picture of me with pink hair. I'm doing blue right now, but I still have the picture of me with pink hair. So if people are trying to find you, Peter, what should they look for as flags that this is really you?
Oh, you know, our symbol right now is usually the TO map from the medieval world. It shows Asia, Europe, and Africa all in a kind of a circle. So I always love that. It kind of represents the medieval world to me. We try and put it as medievalists or medievalist.net, you know, where we can. Some apps, some of these social medias don't like the dot.
Yeah.
So we try and kind of do that. Hopefully go to the website. We would keep you up to date on what's going on, where we are.
Yeah. Always go to medievalist.net when you want to know what's going on with medievalist.net.
Yes.
For me, my website, danielsapolsky.com. It's got all my social links, so I will make sure that those stay updated. All right. Enough of that social media stuff. Peter, tell us what's going on your website. What's going on?
Well, you know, there was another medieval coin discovered in Canada. Woohoo!
Woohoo!
This one is a gold coin. Again, it was discovered in Newfoundland. And what's really interesting about it, it's dated from between 1422 and 1427. which is really early. Like the previous one was 1490s. So obviously, we don't think anyone was there in the mid-14th century hopping around Newfoundland, but it's kind of a mystery on how it got there, right? It was found in an archaeological context. They're keeping tight-lipped on exactly where and how it was discovered. Maybe there's a little more to the story.
Interesting. So you're going to have an article on that.
Yeah, we got a piece on that. I finally got the piece on the Annals of Quedlinburg. And I remember I talked about that like a couple months ago with you, but it took me forever. But it's an amazing piece. It was a chronicle written by a nun at Quedlinburg Abbey. And what's really interesting beyond just, you know, hey, this is a very rare kind of source, is some of the content, how it talks about how influential these women are, especially the abbesses. And this is very much connected to the Ottonian dynasty. So like literally at one of the abbesses is also serving as regent for the empire. These are important people. And it's really interesting to see how we have that. Jack Wilson has a really good piece about writing in the Mongol Empire and how Genghis Khan and his descendants made use of that. And you never kind of think that the Mongols written in a scribal culture, but they certainly do. So I was fascinated with that. I've got pieces on prisoners of war in the Middle Ages and a look at how the population of South Asia was in medieval times. India, Pakistan, that particular area was more populous than medieval Europe throughout the Middle Ages. So it's definitely an area we probably should know more about.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of sources, but maybe they're not in English. So it's great that there are sources that we can access for English speakers, you know, to have a better idea of what's going on in the subcontinent.
Yeah, I think as scholars take a look more at the medieval globe, I think we'll have a lot more access to that kind of resources and things like that, because I think there are a lot of fascinating, from what I can see, there's lots of fascinating stories to tell.
Yeah, of course. So it's always great to see that coming to the fore. So thank you for your work on that, Peter, and all of the work that you're doing on medievalist.net. And we will see you on the website, if not on social media.
Indeed. Thanks.
Thanks. Thank you, as always, to the people who support this podcast via medievalist.net's Patreon page. Patrons can access all sorts of fun stuff like subscriptions to the Medieval Magazine and Medieval World Magazine, as well as ad-free versions of this podcast. As a bonus, you'll also receive eternal gratitude from yours truly. To become a patron, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from queens and kings to bishops and pawns, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalist. You can find me, Danielle Sobalski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite bookstores, where you can get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.